They want justice. They want answers.
What stands out to you about his personality?
What's the family want most of all?
But you were just the last person to see her.
Get
there's
out of my
an
yard
arrest warrant.
And leave.
You have a lot of weighty accusations.
A teenage girl targeted in a triple murder in California. The two men convicted say they're innocent. One is a war hero, awarded the Purple Heart, but the verdict divided a community and left a community shattered. But first, deep in the Ozarks, a strange and twisting tale of love, betrayal, and a murder plot that ends with a man dead and his wife missing. Two chilling cases, one episode, and the forensic expert who helped crack both cases.
You start finding little tiny pieces of bone fragments. It wasn't known at the time if these were human or not. You know, it could have been, you know, it was hogs, it could have been animal remains, you know. But then we found a human tooth. And so that kind of gave us the confidence to keep going.
It was their 14th wedding anniversary, March 1st, 2004. Ted and Ann Thronberry vanished without a trace from their quiet ranch tucked deep in the Arkansas Ozarks. No forced entry, no sign of a struggle, just a locked home in silence. As hours turned into days, neighbors grew worried. A sheriff's deputy kicked open the front door. The lights were off. Ted's wallet and jacket were inside. His truck was parked out front. The beds were made. But the Thronberrys were gone. Were they kidnapped? Did they run away together? Or was something much darker hiding in those hills? Part 1, The Perfect Couple. Ted and Ann Thronberry had what locals called a good life. Ted was a hardworking pipe fitter, often away for days on jobs. Ann ran the ranch. They grew vegetables, raised animals, and lived a modest, faith-driven life in Van Buren County. But behind the curtain of stability, something was unraveling. March 1st was their anniversary, but Ted never made it to work. Ann didn't show up at the feed store or at church, and their phones went unanswered. A welfare check revealed no signs of forced entry, but something about the silence, well, it felt staged. That's when investigators learned about two ex-cons who had recently become close with the Thronberrys, men who had shared a prison sentence, men who now live deep in the woods next to them, and men who might have had a reason to keep quiet. Part 2, The Cabin in the Woods. Their names were Mark Anthony Holsenbach and William James Fraser. He was also known as Billy. Mark was a family friend to Ann and Ted, and Billy, well, he was a drifter. Both had done time in Louisiana, and both had been hired by Ann to help with their ranch work. The police officers that day drove deep into the Ozark Mountains to visit Mark's log cabin. His wife, Karen, greeted them, nervous and quiet, she said. She hadn't seen Ted or Ann, but her unease was obvious. And days later, she made a call that changed the case. From a woman's shelter, Karen whispered into the phone, "Ann is alive, but she's being held against her will. Please help her before it's too late." Part 3, The Shootout. Officers executed a search warrant at the cabin where the two men lived. That's when bullets went flying. Arkansas State Trooper Charlie Edmondson was shot. The suspected shooters were Mark and Billy, and they were with Ann. They all escaped into the vast wilderness of the Ozark National Forest. Now, it wasn't just a missing person case, it was a manhunt, with the FBI, ATF, and state troopers swarming the hills. For 11 days, nothing, no sightings or clues, just tension. Was Ann a hostage or a willing accomplice? Part 4, A Strange Request. Weeks after the shootout, a call came from Newton County. A homeowner had been visited by a man and woman, hungry, dirty, asking for water and food. He quietly phoned the police. When they arrived, they found Mark and Ann. Ann was taken into protective custody, and Mark, he was arrested. So what was Ann's story? She said her husband, Ted, had been kidnapped. Mark had shot Ted when he refused to give them money. She'd been forced to flee with her captors. She had no choice. And that's when her story began to unravel. Mark captured, he blamed Billy. So finding out it was all pinned on him when Billy was caught the next day, he was certainly ready to talk. Act 5, the charred remains. Officers searched Mark's property. They found a plastic barrel. Inside, burned human remains, reduced to ash and bone fragments. The DNA confirmed what many feared. Ted Thromberry was dead, beaten with a hammer, bound with duct tape. His body burned and discarded on a farm road near his home. In his confession, Billy claimed the killing was no accident. It had been planned, calculated, and cold. Now, before I go into why this all happened and what eventually happened to Ann, his wife, I want to introduce a special guest, someone who worked on this case, because finding out what happened to Ted Thromberry was absolutely diabolical, difficult, complex, and this woman helped solve the case. Joining me now is Dr. Elaine Pope. She is a fatal fire forensic consultant and anthropologist who basically studies how bodies are burned, which is critical for many reasons. One of them is to help determine if a fire set is accidental or if it's perhaps a cover-up for a bigger picture crime. And she's been involved in many high-profile cases. Thank you for being here, Elaine.
Thank you.
So first, before we get into two cases that you were involved in out of Arkansas and then Southern California, which are so captivating to me, I just want to know, how did your life came to be? Why this field, and how is the training so pivotal? Why is it so important for people, this level of training?
Well, I became a forensic anthropologist in studying through the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and then University of Arkansas. And basically my love of bones and my love of fire just kind of combined them both. Basically pursued a degree through forensic anthropology at the University of Arkansas. And my dissertation was the effects of fire on human remains and how the body burns. So I just became really interested in burn bones. There was a lot of information when I was doing my studies. There was a lot of information about what happens to the body with like gunshot wounds, stab wounds, beatings. But when you got to the description of fatal fires, there'd be like a paragraph. And so there wasn't a whole lot of information out there. And so I kind of wanted to, see how the body burns and what type of information you can get from a burn victim's body.
So as a former correspondent, I've covered many stories, homicides that were covered up or attempted cover-ups with fire. Is Yes. that an increase in crimes that you're seeing, or is it just something that we are now more knowledgeable about in identifying?
I guess more knowledgeable, or at least from my perspective, seeing, a lot of my cases do involve the use of fire to cover up murders or identity of the victim. You have fatal fires all the time, from accidental fires, structure fires, vehicle fires. But specifically using fire to destroy evidence of a body has been around and is still going pretty strong.
You also work with donated cadavers to help fire and police agencies train. I'm assuming it helps them, since they're first responders, to identify if they're approaching a crime scene or not. What is that like? What's that training like?
So the training, we use human cadavers. They're donated by the family members, so with consent, to use for law enforcement training. Basically, we're able to replicate different types of fire scenes, so structure fires, vehicle fires, outdoor fires, incendiary fires, a whole variety of different types of fire scenes. So that way we can understand how the body burns uniquely in each scene. In applying it to some of these cases, I'm able to take what has been researched in a controlled setting and apply it to actual cases. Where some of the variables are unknown in terms of time, duration, you know, the types of burn patterns on the body, how the body responds during a fire, and what it looks like kind of afterwards. And so try to train investigators to recognize fire patterns on the body, those that are important, those that are, you know, just normal heat-related changes, and then how to properly process a fatal fire scene to collect the maximum amount of evidence of the victim's body for analysis.
In layman's terms, because I'm not anywhere near your level of expertise, but it does the pattern of the burn have something to do with a potential homicide that isn't obvious through a bullet in the skull or a bullet in the body? Say there was a strangulation, right? And that was covered up by a fire. Is that where the pattern comes in, or how do you attempt to solve something like that?
I look at the burn patterns in terms of, are they consistent with how that body had burned? Say for example, outdoor fire scenes, you know, was there refueling? Was there, you know, an attempt to destroy the evidence of the body? Was there crushing? Was there secondary location of the remains? During autopsy, that's when they're going to determine if the person was shot, if they were beaten, if they were strangled or stabbed, because they're going to look at the internal injuries. Whereas I'm looking at kind of the external injuries of the fire damage to the different tissues of the body, which can include skin, fat, muscle, bones, organs. And my specialty is kind of bones. So the types of cases I get are a little bit more extensively burned than, say, just a regular, you know, 3-minute structure fire where there's just superficial burn damage.
Let's dive deep into one that was brought to your attention. It is the disappearance out of rural Arkansas of Ted Thornberry. Where was this investigation? Where was the stage that it was at when it came to your attention? It was back in 2004. So where was the investigation at?
Yes, so I was at the University of Arkansas getting my doctorate degree. We were contacted to come and help search for potential human remains. We didn't necessarily know that they were burned. He could have been buried. He could have been anywhere on the property. So we were looking for, you know, intact parts, parts that had been burned or scattered or damaged. And so we were called out to the scene, escorted by law enforcement. We were always, you know, under the supervision of law enforcement on property. Basically, they showed us an area they thought that the body had been burned, and then kind of going off of what, you know, different stories that people had said, they originally described the burn event as placing the victim's body in a large barrel full of ignitable liquids, which is kind of dumb because everything under the water or under the fluid line is going to stay protected. So it was not very not a very good idea. Then they found a kind of a burn pit, just an outdoor trash pit, which, you know, in Arkansas that's not uncommon, basically, especially on rural property. But when we got there, they had taken excavators and dug up the entire site. So we weren't able to see the original context of the fires, you know, of the burn site. And so we did.
Now, is this information that you were all following from the confession of those in custody at that point? Was this a confession details that you had to work on?
This was just kind of things that law enforcement were talking about as hypotheticals. Okay. It may have been information that the defendants may have provided. But I remember them saying they tried first in a burn barrel, that wasn't successful. And so they likely burned him in that kind of outdoor fire pit. But we couldn't find anything. So we started searching the property a little bit more because at this point they, you know, assumed that he had been burned, cremated. It was in the hills of the Ozark Mountains, and so rural property. So we started walking down this kind of dirt road. It was on the steep hill, and then there was also I guess, again, they had mentioned that he was possibly taken from that burn site, loaded all the debris, loaded into a front end loader of a tractor, and taken down, you know, down on the other parts of the property. So we started searching the dirt road, and it was on a steep hill. So it basically, it would go down, it would level out, it would go down, level out. And the property owners had previous to us being out there, they had kind of graded it. They had kind of freshly, exposed the soil and the gravel and whatnot. And then there had also been several rains. So this was important because it washed down some of the bones, but then also it washed, like, cleaned the bones, so we were able to see them on the surface.
This was an attempted cover-up by resoiling and laying, repatching, if you will, but the rain washed up that cover-up in a sense.
Yes, and it exposed a lot of the bones since they had been washed away, because originally they would have been kind of, you know, covered in soil, they would have been more camouflaged and whatnot.
Do you recall the sizes of the biggest bone? I mean, I'm interested in how obvious to the eye you were able to spot it.
Yeah, so the largest one was about 28 millimeters, teeny tiny little pieces. And then we found like 350 bone fragments and then 5 teeth. And so it was interesting, we're going down this road, dirt road, and every now and then you would see like kind of chop marks in some of the trees with red paint transfer, which was consistent with the front end loader of the tractor that the property owners had. And so each time we would find that, we'd look down and basically we're looking for pieces of charcoal, like burned wood. And so within some of the charred wood debris piles or little clusters, you start finding little tiny pieces of bone fragments. Ones that were, you know, the size of a penny or smaller, some were a little bit larger. But basically the water had washed down a lot of the fragments, and where it went down and then leveled out is where we found a lot of the bone fragments kind of clustered together where the water had kind of washed it down. And so with that, we started flagging everything, you know, as soon as we saw a potential bone fragment, because it wasn't known at the time if these were human or not. You know, it could have been, you know, it was hogs, it could have been animal remains, you know. But then we found a human tooth. And so that kind of gave us the confidence to keep going. And so basically we started finding other bone fragments, long bones. We started finding pieces of the skull, and more teeth. Like I said, we found 5 teeth. It was indeterminate in terms of being able to establish his age, his sex, but we were able to say this is an adult, single individual, and adult human, basically. Basically, we came in, did the search and recovery, and then we submitted those skeletal fragments back to the crime lab in Little Rock, and they made the final decision on the case.
Where does this stand on your range of all the cases you've worked? Is just the complexity and just even the cover-up alone and the difficulty of finding it all since it was transported in ashes, essentially. How does this stack up to some of the other cases? I mean, the level of difficulty.
Oh, this one was fun because it was like little pieces of a jigsaw. The guy got really creative in terms of, you know, effectively burning the body down to what would be considered ash, which is just little chunks of bone fragments, and then scattering them, taking them to a secondary location. So got really creative in trying to dispose of this victim's body. So this is kind of one of my more favorite cases in terms of just the complexity that they went through to, you know, destroy evidence of the victim.
Luckily for the rainfall, the big reveal helping you out. What stands out to you about working this case?
I was more fascinated with the creativity that they put into, and the, not necessarily thought, but I mean, they kind of they weren't the average criminal. They went the extra mile to really try to destroy evidence of the body.
Let's pick up now with part six. Why did Ted Thornberry have to die? Well, according to Billy Fraser, Ann and Mark had been having an affair. While Ted was away on work trips, they grew closer by the day. Ann wanted her husband Ted gone, and Mark wanted Ann. Billy? Well, he says he was just the muscle, the pawn, and he boasted about it. They waited for Ted one day to return home from work. Then Mark struck him with a hammer. They tied him up, took his wallet, his boots, his belt, even his paycheck. According to testimony at trial, Mark told Ted, "I'm your judge, jury, and executioner." Then they killed him. Billy said his wife Ann helped dispose of the body in, as we just heard, to elaborate measures. Mark Holzenbach was tried for capital murder, attempted capital murder for shooting Officer Edmondson when they went to search his cabin in the woods that day, and then also kidnapping. His legal team argued that the kidnapping charge couldn't stick, that the only testimony connecting him to it was Billy's, but the court ruled otherwise. So why? Why did this all have to happen? Because Mark's own statements corroborated Billy's account. He admitted Ted had been tied up, that Ted was, quote, moaning in a bad way, that he'd been restrained before he suffered a brutal death. Under Kansas law, accomplice testimony must be corroborated, but Mark, in a recorded interview, essentially confirmed everything that Billy had said. The jury, they didn't buy Mark's denials in the beginning. He was convicted on all counts and sentenced to life without parole, and that's where he remains. So, where are the other two right now? Well, Ann Thornberry, believe it or not, she was convicted of manslaughter, kidnapping, and hindering apprehension. She was sentenced to 28 years. She then became eligible for parole in 2015 and was released 6 years after in 2021. She's out free, and she maintains her innocence till this day. She denies the affair, and she says that she was manipulated, coerced, and afraid for her life. Billy Fraser was sentenced to 30 years, and as of this recording, he remains in prison, but his parole hearing is approaching. So now, one man is dead, two others are behind bars, and a woman walks free, paroled out, saying she didn't plan the murder, she didn't want it, and she didn't benefit from it. So, was Anne a mastermind or a manipulated survivor? Was Billy a confessor or a scapegoat? And is this the full truth buried somewhere deep in the Ozarks, burned, scattered, and still waiting to be unearthed? I'd like to thank the brilliant Dr. Elaine Pope for her contribution to solving this case. It was extensive and complex, and all the cases that she's worked on, helping to lock up those who tried to cover up their crimes in the ashes. It's her expertise that pieces together the most complex scorched puzzles. Now let's leave Arkansas and dive deep into a triple murder out of Southern California in Pinyon Pines, which is, for reference, it's near Palm Springs, about an hour away. A 911 call comes into police just before 10 p.m. on September 17th in 2006, saying a house is on fire. When fire and police arrive, they see a torched house and an active fire of a body still inflamed in a wheelbarrow outside the house. That body was 18-year-old Becky Friedley. Inside what was once the family home was her mom, Vicky, 53 years old, and her live-in boyfriend, 55-year-old John Hayward. The mom, Vicky, was found to be shot in the head with a handgun, and boyfriend John was shot in the chest with a shotgun. So it seems two guns, two different guns, perhaps indicating two people, two shooters. And young Becky's body was so badly burned, it was difficult to determine her cause of death. And Dr. Pope was called in to help out on this case as well, specifically with what happened to Becky Friedley.
What stage was this investigation at?
I was contacted in 2015. And the case had occurred, I believe, in 2006. So I was contacted by the prosecutor, who basically wanted me to look at the fire patterns on Rebecca, who was found burning inside of a wheelbarrow. The other two victims, they were found inside of a structure fire. They'd both been shot, so there was no question about that. But they wanted to know kind of a timeline of how long she had been burning, the different types of fire patterns on her body and what they meant. And it was basically, you know, related directly to how she burned inside this wheelbarrow. And so that's how I became kind of involved in that case. No, they never found a cause of death. It was ruled undetermined. The other two victims, they were both shot, but I don't think they found a cause of death on her beyond that she was, you know, extensively burned beyond recognition.
The first thing that stood out to me when I read more about this was the fact that fire and police responders had to show up to the scene to see this young body actively inflamed. I'm sure that doesn't happen often, and the toll that it takes emotionally on those first responders must have been horrific to see.
Absolutely, yes.
That's not something you see, especially to know as an 18-year-old girl. So how did you determine the patterns and what Becky, we'll just refer to her as Becky Friedley, what did you find when you looked at the way her body was burned? Was there anything determined?
Well, so she was, as a result of being in that wheelbarrow, it was a kind of a confined space where the liquids had nowhere to go. And so there was, I believe, a lighter fluid used. So that only burns for a little bit. But we started to get involvement of body fat. So when you get involvement of body fat and when you heat it up, it turns to grease. So it becomes a fuel source that fuels the fire.
Neighbors were stunned. The Friedley home was isolated, peaceful. Who would want this family dead, and why this level of brutality? So investigators began asking questions. Was this a robbery gone wrong? Was it revenge or something far more personal? There were whispers at the time. Becky's father, Ron Friedley, a retired sheriff's deputy, was one of the first people scrutinized. Some wondered, was he even the target? Had his past career, maybe, followed him home? But Ron was quickly ruled out. He had an alibi. He was 11 hours away, and he also passed a polygraph. Then came another theory. Maybe Becky was the target all along. CBS News ended up interviewing Becky's father, and he said that she had a private, deep-seated fear of fire. Her dad said, as a child, she had been burned in a kitchen accident, third-degree scars that only someone close to her would even know about this story or this fear. So, was this just arson? A message? Was it psychological warfare? Answers started to come in from Becky's friends. Javier, he was one of them. He said the night of the murder, Becky told him she had plans to go hiking with her ex-boyfriend, Robert Pappy, and his best friend, Christian Smith. Now, Robert and Becky, they had dated for about 15 months, but broke up earlier that year. And according to Becky's close friend, Janine, the breakup, it had not gone smoothly. Becky allegedly confided that Robert had once even threatened her life during the trauma of the breakup. Still, investigators, they treaded carefully. Pappy and Smith denied any plan to meet up with Becky. They claimed that they were headed to church that night, but it was closed. Then they went back to Smith's dad's house and played paintball and even video games. But phone records told a different story. At 7:13 p.m., Robert Pappy's phone pinged near Highway 74, the road to Becky's home. And then silence. Both phones went dark from 7:30 to 10 p.m., the time the murders are believed to have occurred. That was enough to raise eyebrows, but not enough to arrest. And for years, nothing would move the needle. It would go cold. 6 years later, Becky's father turned to a private investigator who put up a very controversial billboard. We'll show the billboard. Becky's face, smiling on one side, in a simulation of her burning body in a wheelbarrow on the other. Now, the media attention, it worked, and the tips, they started pouring in. Then later, another lead, Becky's cousin, Daniela, comes forward. She remembered Becky being harassed by Robert at her job just the day before her murders, and now prosecutors felt that they had enough. In 2014, Robert Pappy and Christian Smith, they were arrested. Just 6 months after their arrest, in a stunning turn of events, prosecutors dropped the charges. No detail explained. But sidebar, just from being a crime reporter for many years, it's usually because the detectives and prosecutors were at odds, with the detectives thinking they had enough evidence, albeit circumstantial, and the DA saying it's not enough to move forward. It's not enough to have a clear win. So often the DA will not move forward if it's a risk. Smith and Pappy's families, they were so relieved, emotional, as their sons were released and allowed to go home. But the joy was short-lived because in 2016, 2 years later, they were re-arrested for the murders. This time, the state had a new informant, new DNA analysis, improved cell phone mapping, and they said a match to a business card found at the crime scene with Christian Smith's DNA. Still, the defense cried foul. The trial began in 2018, 12 years after the murders. The prosecution said this was a calculated crime. Robert couldn't let Becky go. He lured her out to a hike and brought Smith along and killed not only her, but everyone inside the house. They pointed to a message Robert once sent to a girlfriend joking about burning down someone's house. They said this was a pattern, an obsession with fire, with control. The defense said it's all circumstantial. There was no gun, no witnesses, no motive, no real evidence, no physical evidence. Now, this was interesting. Information to learn about one of the suspects, this Christian Smith. He was a decorated Army Ranger. He was a decorated Army veteran, having served various tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he had been awarded 2 Purple Hearts, according to CBS reports. Those Purple Hearts are for acts of bravery. Robert was a church-going man with no criminal past. So, could 2 clean-cut teenagers really commit such a savage act? After 10 days of deliberation, the jury returned the verdict. Robert Pappy, guilty of first-degree murder for Vicky and John. Second-degree murder for Becky. Christian Smith, guilty of first-degree murder for Vicky and John, and not guilty in Becky's death. Robert Pappy and Christian Smith remain behind bars. Their families insist they are innocent, that the real killer is still out there. But the Friedleys believe they're guilty, and the right people are behind bars. So the fire in Pinyon Pines may be long extinguished, but the flames of doubt and grief, they still burn in this community. This has been Killer Genes. Subscribe for more true crime stories where genetics, justice, and tragedy collide right here each week.